All right, so this is BIO-241, September 27th, and we're scheduled to have an exam a week from today. We might get through most of the material in two lectures, but I'm thinking about postponing the test until Thursday of next week. So if we have some questions, we can have some more fun with the material. It's relatively challenging, but that only gives you an extra day to study, so I don't know if that's really great or not. But that's okay because our first test was on Tuesday, so this one's on a Thursday, so it picks on both labs kind of equally that way. And then we'll probably go back to a Monday test the next time. All right, but this is the last chapter that's going to be on that test, and it's chapter 7, Nervous System. Yeah, hi. Oh, I'll have to check. I'll have to check. Okay? I'll have to check. Thanks for pointing that out to me. I'll check. You find those pre-lecture reading assignments helpful? You do. Okay. I'll see what happened with that. A number of strange things have happened in Blackboard. And that is, I know it's supposed to be compatible with some mobile devices. Some people have taken a quiz with a mobile phone and Blackboard made you work through the quiz just fine and you saved and submitted and then completely forgot to enter any information into Blackboard. So there were some attempts done with the mobile devices. I don't know what kind of phones they were, and Blackboard had no idea that you went in and took the quiz. And to me it looks like you didn't even log into Blackboard with it. So be careful using mobile devices. That's the only thing I can ask you. Make sure that you submit a quiz well in advance of the deadline so that you can go to a computer someplace, either a tablet or a laptop or a desktop, and check your scores to see that it got entered in. Okay, and if it didn't, then I'm sorry, you'll have to take the quiz again before the deadline. So, and then there's a whole handful of people that used the cell phone just fine and entered a quiz. And so I have no idea why it works with some and not others. I don't know if it's the service or if it's the cell phone or the browser that you're using in the cell phone. I'm not exactly sure, but you have to double check. All right, so after the first couple times, I can't allow you to take a test after the deadline because your cell phone didn't work. All right, so this is just kind of a new technology because I get no indication if it doesn't work on the cell phone that you even were logged onto Blackboard, okay? The second thing is that when you are taking a quiz, since the upgrade, sometimes the quiz page reloads while you're taking the quiz and it erases all your answers and it puts a paper symbol in your gradebook, and that's a real nightmare because that means that I have to spend about 2 or 3 minutes for every time that happens to clear that grade out, even though it's a zero. And it's a pain for you because, well, you're right in the middle of the quiz maybe sometimes, and you get no credit for the work that you're doing. And then students log back in at another time, and it seems to be working perfectly. And I can't figure out what the browser is or what the computer operating system is or what the issue is with that. But anyway, it's a hassle for both you and me.
I downloaded Firefox, and then it worked.
Okay. So even though the upgrade, Internet Explorer is supposed to work, Chrome is supposed to work, mobile devices are supposed to work, it still seems as if the best browser is Firefox. And maybe even the latest version, and the latest version is what, 5? 6.0. Okay, so if you have an older version of Firefox, I know that works pretty well, but maybe even the newer versions will work just fine. Okay, so I'd still kind of stay clear of when you're taking a quiz, some of these other browsers, I would still use Firefox. But if you're wondering whether or not your particular setup, whether it's your internet connection and computer and browser and operating system, work with Blackboard, you can always take a forever quiz. All right? And then for a regular quiz, it doesn't matter because you can take it as many times as you want to anyway. Even if you get a paper and pencil symbol, eventually I'll be able to clear those up. But if everybody submits like 20 quizzes, I have like a couple hundred, 300 students. It's going to take me a while to clear all those paper symbols out of everybody's quizzes. Yeah, another question. Yeah, it means manually I have to clear, and I can't do a batch file. I have to do them one at a time, and it takes about 3 minutes to do each one of those. But still, I want you to go back in and use those quizzes as practice for the exams. All right, so they're still important. So even though you get paper symbols, it's still probably important. You'll eventually get the credit. You might have to see me during office hours, and we'll have to sit down together so I don't get distracted by other questions from students and things like that. Okay, so just keep persevering with that. So that's it. So maybe some people came in late. So the test is not one week from today, but it's going to be on Thursday of next week, not Tuesday. Yeah, it's going to be Thursday of next week. All right, so nervous system. And I know you all remember your nervous system from when you took anatomy, and for some reason that always seems to be the hardest core material in anatomy, and that's, I think, because people just aren't used to looking at what a brain looks like. It's this amorphous blob that's stuck up in your head someplace. All right, but you might have to go back and just kind of review some of your anatomy for nervous system. We'll review some histology of the nervous system. But remember, the nervous system in general can be broken down into two main areas. And those two main areas are, yell it out at me, central nervous system and peripheral nervous system. And I supposedly that means something to you. Like, what the heck is the central nervous system in terms of structure? It is the brain and spinal cord, and these are contained in that dorsal body cavity that's heavily armored with bones, whether it's the cranial bones or the vertebral column, right, protects the central nervous system. And then everything else is what? The peripheral nervous system. Everything that leaves that armor plating becomes the peripheral nervous system. So that includes all the nerves in your body. Cranial and spinal nerves are the two divisions of ways that nerves can enter or leave the central nervous system, right, either cranially or through the vertebral column, and those are what we call spinal nerves. And then you should probably have some other organization in your mind. For instance, in the peripheral nervous system, all right, there's different ways to think of the peripheral nervous system. There are nerves that bring information into the central nervous system, so bringing information in is what, sensory or motor? Sensory, right? So if your eyes are receiving light information that gets changed into action potentials, those action potentials enter the central nervous system, that's sensory. But there's other ways that information can travel from the central nervous system out to the periphery, and that's what we call a motor pathway. So you can have sensory or motor. Another way that you could think of the peripheral nervous system is that part of it controls skeletal muscles that you have voluntary control over. And then there's another part of the nervous system that controls things like your heart and controls things like smooth muscle that lines the organs inside your body, right? And those you don't have, or glands, for instance. So that kind of information you don't have direct control over. So the nervous system that controls skeletal muscle is what we call your somatic motor nervous system. Somatic means going out through your body, and it's voluntary control. And what's the other nervous system that takes care of things automatically for you? Autonomic nervous system. Okay, so these are just some ways to think of the nervous system, and we'll look at some cells that do this and pathways and neurotransmitters and all that kind of cool stuff in this chapter. All right, so if we're going to think of the nervous system, whether it's central or peripheral, there are two kinds of cells that make up nervous tissue. And there are cells that actually carry chemical information electrically, and those are neurons. And then there are the cells that support the job of what the neurons do. And those are what we call glial cells, or neural glial cells, or neuroglia cells. There's different ways of pronouncing it, and depending on whether it's Tuesday or Thursday, I'll pronounce it differently, just for fun, okay? So neurons are what we call the functional units, the structural and functional units of the nervous system. And for years and years and years, people were very interested only with neurons because they transmit electrical information long distances very rapidly in your body. Right? But more recently, we found that neurons really can't do their job unless the support cells are guiding them. And so now people are very interested in the glial cells because they actually help control many functions within the nervous system. They control what the neurons are doing. So the glial cells maintain homeostasis. They make the nervous system function properly. And you have more than five times as many glial cells than you do neurons. So I want you to be able to identify both neurons and their support cells, the glial cells, by their shape, right? So and that I think you kind of learned in anatomy, but in this class you also have to know what their function is as well. So I want you to be able to identify a neuron as to being sensory or motor by its particular shape. And where you might find certain glial cells by their shape, are you going to find them in the central nervous system or peripheral nervous system? So let's start to look at some of these cells, and a good place to start is with neurons. So the general function of a neuron is that they gather information, and as a matter of fact, they can integrate that information up. They can make sense of that information and then transmit it a long distance. Right? So they can respond to stimuli. They produce and send electrochemical impulses that we're going to call action potentials. And they can release chemical messages to stimulate or excite other cells within the body. So neurons can do a whole bunch of stuff. So here is, we got two examples of what two kinds of neurons look like. And the top one right over here is what we call a multipolar neuron because it has all these projections coming off of it. And the main center of this neuron right here, and the neuron is the yellow color. How's that? Or gold? What does it kind of look like? Hopefully it's not green. Yellow. Okay, so the yellow is a neuron. I see some other cells associated with it, which kind of look more beige to me, kind of washed out, gray maybe. Right? These are support cells or glial cells, and these are not neurons. Right? So anytime you see a little yellow or gold, that's part of the neuron. As a matter of fact, I can see a little piece of gold right here. That's an underlying part of the neuron underneath the glial cell. Okay. So these projections have two different names. These short projections that are highly branched, these are what we call dendrites. The major part of the cell that contains the nucleus and a bunch of organelles. The organelles are not illustrated in the diagram here, but they're in there, like smooth endoplasmic, rough endoplasmic reticulum. This is what we call the cell body. And there is a name that means cell body, and that is soma. Anytime you hear that word soma, you should think of body, whether it's your own body, that's your soma, or if it's the body of this neuron right here, that's the soma of the neuron. And it contains the organelles. And then there's another projection or process coming out the cell, and this one here is really long. This is what we call an axon. So because they have different shapes, what can you imagine? What about the dendrites and this axon right here? They have different functions. Okay, and we're going to look at the molecular basis and understand what the different molecules are in the cell membrane that give these dendrites and axons different kinds of functions. So, let's talk in general what the functions are. Notice you see an arrow, the direction of conduction of electrical activity. On this axon, is it moving away or toward the cell body? It's away, that's right. So these neurons conduct electrical information, and it conducts it in a one-way direction, in the direction of this arrow. It's going to carry it from a dendrite to a cell body, down an axon, down to these axon terminals right here. And if you look really carefully at these axon terminals, you can see that there's a little swelling. And that's going to be a real important structure that we're going to look at in just a little bit. The axon terminus, sometimes it's called a terminal button, or an axon terminal, or a synaptic button, or a Bouton terminale, or a terminal button. It runs around with all kinds of different names, okay? Just like you and I do. It all depends. And these axons can bifurcate. We can see right here forming these collateral axons. But even if it's a collateral axon, information still can only travel in one direction, and that is away from the cell body down to these little terminal buttons right here. So think of these dendrites receive information. They have special proteins that can receive information. A way of thinking of an axon is that, is it receiving information? I would say no, it is more sending information. So maybe you have a black and white TV set from the 1990s or 1980s, and you don't have a cable connection form, what do you need on that kind of TV set? You need an antenna, right? So think of these dendrites right here as like being an antenna listening for signals that other cells are trying to send it. And it's going to pick up those signals, and then it's going to make a decision to send some of those signals down the axon to these axon terminals. This multipolar neuron is typical of what we see of a somatic motor neuron. So these are the kinds of neurons that take information from the central nervous system out to the periphery. So the cell bodies are going to be in the CNS someplace, but the axons are going to be in the peripheral nervous system. They're going to be part in and part out of the central nervous system. This neuron down over here is what we call a unipolar or pseudo-unipolar neuron. And so there's one projection that bifurcates. There are two long processes. And these processes, for instance, we see the direction of this impulse. It is received by these dendrites. There's special proteins in these dendrites that receive signals that then send the electrical information toward the central nervous system, and then it enters the nervous system maybe right about in this region right here. So these two processes have two names. This is going to be the peripheral process because it's in the periphery of your body, so this is part of the peripheral nervous system, and then when it enters the central nervous system, we call this the central process, right? Because it enters the central nervous system. All right, so this is, we see information coming from the periphery going into the central nervous system. So in terms of function, is this a sensory neuron or a motor neuron? If it's receiving in the periphery, and then we see the axon terminals or the little terminal buttons right here in the central nervous system, this is a sensory, right, neuron. All right. The other thing maybe you can remember is that sensory and motor have synonyms. And some are called afferent and some are called efferent. I'm mispronouncing it a little bit in class so that you can hear that one starts with an E and the other starts with an A. But it's what efferent and afferent if you're going to speak in everyday language. But I'll continue to use efferent and afferent so that I'm easily understood. Afferent is which kind of neuron? Is it sensory or motor? Sensory, right? It is afferent. And efferent is motor going the other way. So multipolar neuron is a nice motor or efferent. A pseudo-unipolar is an afferent or sensory neuron. Okay. But nonetheless, that information is just travels in one direction. And here you can see a difference in cell bodies as well between these two different neurons. Maybe from anatomy, you can remember a group of these pseudo-unipolar neurons, all right, joining together at right at the, what is, how many different ways can information enter or leave the spinal cord? I don't have a picture for you. Maybe you have a picture in your mind. Maybe after we talk about it, you can get that picture developed. There are roots, right? And how many roots are there to the spinal cord? Let's see if I can get to the board without the... So here is spinal cord, and there's some gray and white matter in there that's probably not too important, but it kind of looks like what, a little H right there? And then let's just say this is dorsal, and this is ventral. What's another way of saying ventral? Ventral is anterior, dorsal is posterior. And then, so here's a nice cross section of a spinal cord. And what do the roots look like? Where would I draw a root? All right, so here would be a root coming over here. Crystal, I know you had a fairly decent marker. Let's try a bunch of these right here. All right, so here is a root here. And what root is that? That's the dorsal root. And then there's a root over here. What root is that? That's the ventral root, right? So I'm just going to say DR. Oh, I had all my students draw this out 1,000 times. So this is coming back to you. Which way are signals traveling through this dorsal root? They're traveling in. All right, so this is the sensory root. So that means that the VR, ventral root, which way are signals moving there? They're out, right? So traffic through the roots is what we call either motor or sensory. It's never mixed. But remember, in this dorsal root, there's a special little blob right here. Okay, that was the dorsal root ganglia, right? And we're just going to abbreviate that, dorsal root ganglia, DRG. And why is this little bulge right there? If we look at the PowerPoint slide again, because it contains... Oh, I didn't turn my cursor back on. Here, I found it again. It contains hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands of these cell bodies of a sensory neuron right here in that dorsal root ganglia. So a bunch of nerve cell bodies in the peripheral nervous system is called a ganglion. Ganglion, that's a ganglion. So there are just thousands and thousands of nerve cell bodies of these pseudo-unipolar neurons right there. This motor neuron, on the other hand, is here's a cell body right here with a bunch of dendrites coming out and one long axon. That's just a nice multipolar neuron. So that's typical of what? A motor neuron. Okay, and then I see some more support cells. And we're going to learn the names of these support cells in the peripheral nervous system as being Schwann cells. All right, so cell bodies, the nutritional center, makes macromolecules like neurotransmitters. Groups of cell bodies in the central nervous system, we didn't cover that yet. All right, but groups of cell bodies in the peripheral nervous system are called ganglia. And here we have an example of a ganglia that we drew on the board. Now, there can be groups of nerve cell bodies. Remember, here's a nerve cell body. It could be deep in the brain someplace, and if we put thousands of these things together in the brain, that's not called a ganglion, that's called a nucleus, right? So a nucleus has all kinds of different meanings. You know now three or four. It could be what? The center of an atom. It could be a nucleus, could be the center part of a cell that, or organelle that contains genetic material. Or it could be thousands of these nerve cell bodies someplace in the central nervous system, right? It's still a nucleus. Dendrites receive information because they have, underline it, ligand-gated channels. You'll have no clue. Okay, it might take you a couple days or a week to really appreciate what that means, but that was a good place to start. A ligand-gated channel in the cell membrane means that there's a channel that can allow ions to move through the cell membrane, and it has a gate, and sometimes the gate is open, meaning ions can move. Sometimes the gate is closed, which means ions can't move in and out of the cell through that particular kind of channel. And it's controlled by a ligand. And a ligand is a little molecule that binds to a receptor part of the channel that changes the nature of the gate, either opening or closing the gate. So it's a little molecule. All right, axons conduct impulses away from the cell body because they have voltage-gated channels, right? So both are gated channels. One is ligand-gated, those are in dendrites. The other kind of gate on channels on an axon is controlled by the voltage across the cell membrane or the membrane potential. So it doesn't need a little ligand to bind to a receptor, it just responds to the voltage across the cell membrane. And you actually learned how to calculate that using what kind of equation? The Nernst equation, right? Yeah. So you're kind of familiar with that, but you're going to see why it's important in cells right now. All right. So before we get to some of those electrical details, let's finish up just a little bookkeeping with how molecules can move along an axon. Because if we look at a neuron that we see right here and right here, this axon diameter is going to be, or the radius of this axon is microscopic. You need a good microscope because it's so thin. It's on the order of microns. As a matter of fact, you need a good microscope even to see the cell body right here and the nucleus. Right? But the axon is very long. It could be a meter or two long. It could go all the way from your brain down to the tip of your toe. So that is a very macroscopic kind of structure. That distance is way too long for diffusion to transport molecules. So there has to be other ways for material that's in the cell body to go all the way down to the tip of your toe, and it's through some kind of flow process. Right? And the two kinds of processes will be axoplasmic flow, and the other one is going to be axonal transport. And when you think of axoplasmic flow, you should think of how material moves through your digestive tract. There's smooth muscle in your digestive tract that actually moves material in a process that we call peristalsis from one end of the tube to the other via contraction of smooth muscle. And so axons can actually form constriction and move material from the cell body down toward the axon tip. That's what we're going to call axoplasmic flow via these rhythmic contractions of the axon. So every axon you could think of as like a little mini digestive system in terms of motility anyway. But there's another way that things move as well. And on the first test, okay, you had to study some component of a cell that was important that set up the, like a monorail system inside the cell. What were those things that set up these little, like, railway tracks with inside the cell for moving organelles around the cell or chromosomes around the cell? Those would be the microtubule system. So axons contain microtubules that can move things around inside the cell from the cell body down to the axon terminus or even in the reverse direction, right? And this is what we call axonal transport. Moves large and insoluble compounds in both directions, okay? And it requires microtubules. And it's pretty fast when that happens. Anterograde transport is when something is moved from the cell body down to the tip of an axon. Anterograde means forward direction. So the forward direction, and that kind of is forward because people are thinking of the way that an electrical signal is transmitted in a neuron. How is an electrical signal transmitted in terms of the structure of a neuron? It's going to start dendrite, go to cell body, and then where? Down the axon. So that's kind of what we think is the forward direction or anterograde direction. There is a special little motor protein that will attach itself to microtubules, and we call these kinesin molecules, right? So kinesins are little molecular motors that move materials in the anterograde direction. And I want you to remember anterograde as opposed to the flow that's in the reverse direction. Flow in the reverse direction is what we call retrograde. That's moving backwards. There's a different kind of motor protein that still uses the microtubule system, but it's a different one, all right? And they're called dynein molecules. So dyneins will move material from the axon terminus back up into the cell body, all right? And what do you have in the cell body? That's the major hub of the cell, contains the nucleus, right? That's the living part of the cell. If an axon is damaged or destroyed and the cell body remains alive, then the cell is still alive, right? So the important part of the cell is the cell body or the soma. But if the cell body dies, what happens to all the dendrites in the axon? Then it's dead as well, right? So this is kind of a little dangerous way of moving material because what happens if you move harmful material from an axon terminus into the cell body? Then the whole cell dies. If you take harmful material from the cell body and move it out to the axon, right, then the cell doesn't really die. So this retrograde transport is can be dangerous. As a matter of fact, there are many toxins and viruses gain access to the cell body via this retrograde transport using dynein molecules. So things can actually, there are cells, remember, like that sensory neuron right here, part of it is in the peripheral nervous system and it enters the central nervous system. So this is a way for a virus, right, once it enters these dendrites in the peripheral nervous system to find their way all the way into your spinal cord or brain, okay, using those dynein motor proteins. All right, and that's just kind of an axonal transport mechanism. Okay, both for anterograde and retrograde flow. But don't forget the definitions for anterograde and retrograde. All right, so here's a little slide that kind of goes over the classification of these different neurons by their function. Sensory or afferent bring information into the central nervous system. So here I see a nice spinal cord, and here is a pseudo-unipolar, or you can say unipolar. And the cell body is in the peripheral nervous system. And this is what we call the peripheral process with dendrites, receptor dendrites right here, bringing action potentials in through, what route is that? Okay, not drawn particularly well, but this is a physiology book, not an anatomy book. There's a lot of anatomy mistakes in physiology books. Because where should this be? It should be going in the dorsal root, kind of looks more like the ventral root over here. Okay, but that's okay. But nonetheless, you can see that this is the central process because what part of the nervous system is it in? The central nervous system. And this is the peripheral process because it's in the peripheral nervous system. Okay. So this is a nice afferent neuron. Here is, now what kind of neuron is this? Is this motor or sensory? Look at the direction of the arrow. from CNS to the periphery. So that is a motor neuron. Somatic means that it's going to go to skeletal muscle. Somatic means that you have voluntary control when action potentials move down this axon to control various muscles in your body. It's rare when you send a signal out to your biceps to contract, maybe to lift a glass of water to take a drink, that the biceps or that this motor neuron here says what? No thanks. I don't want to conduct this electrical impulse. It just automatically follows your voluntary thoughts. All right. And how many neurons does it take to go from central nervous system out to a skeletal muscle?
One.
Only one. Okay? And that's true in all cases. And then here we see some motor neurons, and they're nice multipolar neurons. But in this case, how many neurons do you see from the central nervous system to the effector organs out over here? You see two. So this is typical of an autonomic motor pathway. There are two neurons instead of one for somatic. And the effector organs for the autonomic nervous system are smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, and glands. And you don't have voluntary control over these things. You can influence this a little bit one way or the other. Like you can influence your heart rate some, but you can't really stop your heart. Like if we tried really hard right now, none of us could stop our heart because it's controlled by the autonomic or autonomic nervous system. But I just had a thought. Since we're moving so fast in class, you know, we probably shouldn't have the test on Thursday of next week. We should probably have it Tuesday of next week. Let's move it up a day. What do you think? Take your pulse right now. What happened to your heart rate? You don't have control over your heart rate, but your instructor does. Okay, so you can't influence it, but you don't have direct control. So I was just kidding. I was kidding about moving the test up. Okay? Huh? Okay, you came in a little late. The test will be on Thursday of next week, not Tuesday. Okay, the test will be on Thursday. Yeah, not the 4th. It won't be on the 4th. Okay, so you can't influence your autonomic nervous system. Maybe you're even sweating a little bit. Your pupils are dilated now, I can tell. Okay, but you really don't have control over it. Another kind of neuron is what we call an association or interneuron, and it takes the shape of a multipolar neuron, but it will be found only in the central nervous system. It's going to be in what, this blue area over here, either the brain or spinal cord. Okay, that's an association neuron. It integrates information. All right, so, and it's not illustrated on this diagram right here. So I do want you to be able to identify these three kinds of neurons right here by name. Here's a multipolar, here's a pseudo-unipolar, and if you want to call it a unipolar, that's fine with me, but remember there's a peripheral and central process. The third kind of neuron that we haven't talked about is this bipolar neuron. All right, so here is the dendrite, and then here is the axon, and we only know that because maybe the axons have a little axon terminus, a little bulge, little terminal buttons, which I can't really see. Maybe in your book you can see it. But that giveaway is this arrow. So therefore, I know this is the dendrite because the job of a dendrite is to what? Receive information and transmit it to the cell body, and then the cell body sends it down an axon. All right, so I think we talked about all those different kinds of cells. So three kinds of neurons. You should know them by their function and shape. All right, so let's turn our attention to support cells or the glial cells or neuroglia cells, and we're going to find two major types of glial cells, some that are found in the central nervous system, some that are found in the peripheral nervous system. Let's start with peripheral nervous system first. So here is a nice multipolar neuron, and we can see some Schwann cells wrapped around, and I can actually see the layers of wrapping around an axon. So Schwann cells form what we call myelin sheaths around axons in what part of the nervous system? Peripheral nervous system, yeah.
Okay, so a myelin sheath is basically just like the Schwann cell then, or is it like the same thing?
Okay, a myelin sheath right here. All right, let's just talk about a cell first. So here's a Schwann cell. Okay, and a Schwann cell just wraps itself. Let me go to the next slide. Maybe the next slide will show. Okay, so here's a Schwann cell, kind of like a pillow, and it just wraps itself around and around and around. And in these layers that are up against the axon right here don't contain organelles. It only contains a chemical compound called myelin, which is a lipid, right? And lipids don't conduct electricity because it doesn't contain any charged particles, right? Because it's nonpolar material, so it can't conduct electricity. And so this is the myelin sheath. It's just layers and layers and layers of cell membrane. And what can you tell me about the cell membrane? Does it conduct electrical information? You know, a cell membrane, just a phospholipid bilayer itself, is an insulator as well, because the internal part is just what? Fatty acids. So the myelin sheath is just this part of a Schwann cell, which doesn't contain cytoplasm, doesn't contain any charged particles, and it acts as an insulator around the axon. So electrically, the axon is isolated from the extracellular environment. Electrical signals can't pass through. It acts like insulation maybe on a wire. So do you ever have to unplug your toaster at home? Maybe you do. If you want to save electricity or something, you just unplug it. Would you grab the wires of your toaster if it didn't contain rubber or plastic around the wires?
Maybe.
No. Maybe? Okay, yeah, if the wires started burning or something and you had to unplug it, maybe you would try to grab it. But this insulation prevents electrical activity from anything that's trying to grab it from the outside, like your hand. All right, all the cytoplasm, as the Schwann cell wraps around the axon, gets squished to the outer layer right here. So the myelin sheath, you should really think of as these inner layers of the Schwann cell, and the outer layer right here that contains the cytoplasm, like the nucleus and all the other organelles. Sometimes we call that the neurolemma. I don't know if that's, oh, it is on this slide right here. All right, so the neurolemma is just the one or two layers of the Schwann cell that contains cytoplasm. And that actually can probably conduct electricity to some degree, but not these inner layers right here. So how's that? Does that kind of answer your question a little bit? Yeah, the myelin sheath is due to the insulation. Oop, I went forward. Let's go backwards. All right, but notice that the Schwann cells are not continuous. There are gaps between Schwann cells on these axons. And where do you find this axon once again? In the CNS or in the periphery someplace? Out in the periphery someplace. All right, so they have special names. These are called nodes of Ranvier. And now the axon can communicate electrically with the extracellular environment through these spaces right here. And we'll see what effect that has. So axons are myelinated, but it's not completely myelinated. There's still gaps, which we call nodes of Ranvier. The cell body and dendrites are never myelinated on cells anywhere. Okay. Okay. Satellite cells are not drawn on this illustration, but for instance, if this was a neuron, okay, like a unipolar neuron, and the cell body was up over here, satellite cells would completely surround the dendrites and the cell body, and the satellite cells would provide nourishment and other kinds of regulating factors to make the cell body work properly. And since they surround the cell body, that reminded somebody of maybe looking up at Jupiter in the middle of the night, and if you look at Jupiter, you see its moons circling around the planet, and so people said, oh, okay, well, those have to be satellite cells. Because way back then, when people studied biology, they probably had an interest in astronomy and other kinds of scientific disciplines as well, because it wasn't so specialized. All right, so that's it for peripheral nervous system. Here we see a slide of central nervous system. And here we see four kinds of cells in the central nervous system. We see some that wrap myelin sheaths around axons, right? And these we don't call Schwann cells because we're no longer in the central nervous system. But look at the shape of these, right? Here is an oligodendrocyte, and it can wrap a myelin sheath around one segment of an axon, but another segment as well. So multiple segments of an axon can be surrounded with a myelin sheath from an oligodendrocyte. But another distinction is that an oligodendrocyte can even wrap myelin sheaths around other neighboring neurons as well. Right? So it has multiple processes for wrapping a myelin sheath around. And this myelin sheath in the central nervous system plays the same kind of role as the Schwann cell in the peripheral nervous system. And we'll have to get to that in a little bit, because it has these little junctions right here that we call, what? Nodes of Ranvier. And it allows for special kind of electrical communication between the axon and the extracellular environment. All right, so which way is the signal moving from this axon? Is it going this direction, number one, or number two? number one, from dendrite to cell body down an axon. All right, so oligodendrocytes are found in the central nervous system making a myelin sheath. Another kind of cell is an astrocyte right here. And again, it reminded somebody of a star when they first saw it. All right, so that's why it's called an astrocyte. These kind of look like rays from the sun coming out of the star right here. And you can see some of these processes touch the cell body of a neuron, and other processes touch this blood vessel. And this is a capillary. And what do you know about the function of a capillary? If you're going to think of one word, what's the function of a capillary? Exchange is what I'm kind of thinking of, right? So capillaries, by their nature, are a little bit leaky. So material can enter and leave the cardiovascular system only at a capillary. Can't leave at a vein or an artery, which are the other two kinds of blood vessels in the cardiovascular system. Okay. So if we have toxins in this blood vessel right here, sorry, I'm going to have to stop, get a drink. If it was a regular capillary, those toxins could leave the capillary and affect these neurons. And then what might happen to you? Well, you might pass out, right, if it's a sufficient level of toxin. So there is a special structure called the blood-brain barrier that decreases the leakiness of a capillary that's in the brain. All right, and the astrocyte helps make that blood-brain barrier. The other thing that can happen is that if there are nutrients like glucose in this capillary, it can be picked up by an astrocyte and then transferred directly to this neuron. So it's also a door-to-door delivery system. All right, so it acts kind of like a doorway. It prevents toxins from entering the brain, but if it's a helpful substance, it can deliver it directly to a neuron, helping the neuron do its job. So astrocytes are pretty fascinating that way. So you might be wondering, gee whiz, what happens when somebody designs a special drug for the brain, maybe to kill tumors that are in the brain? And if no one has figured out a way how to make that drug get through the blood-brain barrier, guess what? It has no helpful benefit to the patient. So when central nervous system drugs are designed, somebody has to figure out how to get them through the blood-brain barrier. Yeah. Because of the way the drug is engineered, right? The drug has to be built with the right kind of structure so that it can pass through the blood-brain barrier. Otherwise, it just won't help the patient at all. Yeah. It's definitely a poison, right? So you would expect the blood-brain barrier to exclude it from the brain, because these little cells have no idea that you're taking that drug as a benefit, right? Oh yeah, there are ways around it, and different drugs have different modifications to them. But guess what that costs? Millions of dollars to figure out how to do that. Yeah, that's why these chemotherapeutic agents are slow coming to market, and they're really expensive, okay? Because otherwise they don't help the patient. So these astrocytes also perform some kinds of important functions. For instance, a neuron might secrete a signaling compound that's going to signal a neighboring neuron. We call that a neurotransmitter. Astrocytes help recycle these neurotransmitter signaling compounds so that they don't get lost. And then also, even more fascinating, these astrocytes right here can sometimes tell when neurons should regenerate, right? When they should replace themselves. And what is your understanding of neuron replacement in the central nervous system? Like when you get a spinal cord injury, does your spinal cord ever grow back? It sure doesn't, because these oligodendrocytes secrete substances that prevent proliferation or mitosis of neurons, but the astrocytes, on the other hand, are antagonistic to that. They promote the mitosis of neurons within the central nervous system. Usually it's the oligodendrocytes that win out, so that your central nervous system doesn't ever really rebuild itself or repair itself when it becomes damaged. But now we're beginning to know something about these astrocytes, that they do work. And one of the theories of learning is that when you're challenged with new information, your brain actually grows. New neurons actually develop. Your brain grows to help you understand that new information. And it's the job of the astrocyte that secretes neurotrophic compounds that helps your brain actually grow. But that's not the only other thing. The other thing that happens is that maybe the number of cells remains the same, but now the connections between the cells change. You have more connections, more dendrites, more axons, so these neurons can share information much more quickly. So when you're taking a kind of rigorous class, like an anatomy class or physiology class, guess what's happening to your brain? The structure of your brain is actually changing as you're learning things. So the brain that you have after the physiology class is totally different than the brain you had when you walked in the door the very first day. It's better. Well, see, you know, that's kind of like your choice. That's kind of interesting. It kind of depends on who are the people that you're hanging around with. Are you hanging around with people that are applying themselves and studying the right information, or are you hanging around people that are complaining all the time? And it doesn't happen much in this class, because guess what happens to the people that hang around with people that complain all the time? Well, they never get through anatomy, right? Because their brain just never evolve and develop to learn that new information. Yeah. Question, was there a question? Okay, your brain is changing as we think. Okay. It will probably come back to you. Ask me then. All right, so our brains do remodel it, when you take a rigorous class or you learn a musical instrument or a new language or something like that. And so these kinds of cells keep our brains what? Young and alive and adaptable, which we call plasticity. All right, so that's an astrocyte. The fourth kind of cell that we see right here is a microglia cell. And the microglia cell is like a monocyte that has left the blood, right? But it's really a nervous cell, and it can crawl around through the brain. It can crawl around between all these different cells looking for bacteria and viruses and fungi, so you shouldn't have those kinds of infections within the brain. Those can be fatal, lethal, very, very quickly. And they're also looking for tumor cells, right? And so the job of these microglia are for phagocytosis and to secrete substances that will lyse invading microorganisms that try to infect the brain. Okay, so that's the immune system of the central nervous system. Oh no, that's the third kind of cell. Here's the fourth kind of cell. Remember, there are big fluid-filled chambers inside the brain called? What are those big fluid-filled chambers inside the brain? They help float the brain, because your brain doesn't have any bones or muscles in it to support it. So it's kind of floating in its own little bathtub. And it's an internal bathtub because they're inside. They're called ventricles, right? So it has ventricles, lateral ventricles, right? Third and fourth ventricle, that kind of stuff. And those ventricles are filled with cerebrospinal fluid. These cells right here, the ependymal cells, form a barrier between cerebrospinal fluid and the brain. Again, if you have an infection of cerebrospinal fluid, hopefully these ependymal cells are strong enough to keep the infection from actually getting into the brain. All right, so they form a little barrier. But these cells in certain locations actually produce this cerebrospinal fluid that fill up the ventricles. So that's the job. And it kind of looks more like an epithelium, but these are really neuronal cells. And these kind of look like blood cells, but these really are neuronal cells. So all these cells are neuronal cells of some kind or another. All right, so here we see, ooh, what kind of cell is this? Pretend you can't read the lead lines right here. What kind of cell does this look like? It's making myelin sheets. Okay, it kind of looks like a Schwann cell, but look at all these multiple processes coming out, so it can't be a Schwann cell. It's an oligodendrocyte, and where do you find oligodendrocytes? In the central nervous system, okay? And its job to modify the electrical properties of an axon so that it becomes very efficient. The other things that these oligodendrocytes do is that it prevents regeneration of neurons inside the central nervous system. And that's why we don't recover from spinal cord injury. All right, now this one right here. What are these guys right here? These are Schwann cells. So where do you find these? In the peripheral nervous system. These Schwann cells also enhance the electrical properties of these axons because of these nodes of Ranvier. And the Schwann cells don't secrete axonal regrowth inhibitors. So in the peripheral nervous system, it is definitely possible for re-innervation of organs and tissues that are de-innervated because of trauma. So these axons can grow back in the peripheral nervous system because it has Schwann cells, but in the central nervous system, axons don't regenerate because of the oligodendrocytes. Okay, so regeneration occurs much more readily in the PNS compared to the CNS because the CNS has these oligodendrocytes that secrete inhibiting factors, right? It just forms a scar tissue, a glial scar tissue. But in the peripheral nervous system, right, because of these Schwann cells, when an axon is severed right here, of course, the axon that is distal to the site of injury dies and degenerates and gets resorbed. Right, the Schwann cells are still intact. They stay there, and they start to grow. So they regenerate and grow, and they actually form a tube, which we call a regeneration tube. And that tube that's formed by the Schwann cells acts as a little guiding tunnel for regeneration of the axon to what? The original effector organ right here. So that's what we call a regeneration tube. Regeneration tubes arise from what? From the Schwann cells, because the Schwann cells can secrete chemicals that attract that growing axon. So PNS regeneration is relatively easy, but it could take a year, maybe even 2 years, depending on where that injury is. All right, neurotrophins are secreted by astrocytes. They promote fetal nerve growth, and as a matter of fact, they're required for survival of many adult neurons. Maybe not regeneration, maybe not mitosis of neurons, but just to maintain the health of a already healthy neuron in the adult brain. And some neurotrophins can even cause regeneration of new neurons in the brain, and also, and probably even more importantly, is what? The connections. It can stimulate the formation of new connections in the brain for learning. So neurotrophins are important that way. And that's done by astrocytes. What are some other things by astrocytes? How do you know this is an astrocyte right here? Because I see one process going over to a capillary and another process going over to a neuron right here. Right? It can adjust the levels of potassium in the extracellular environment. This axon right here is going to secrete a neurotransmitter, in particular glutamate, and that glutamate can be recycled by the astrocyte. Right, so that the neurotransmitter can be used over and over and over again. Astrocytes regulate neurogenesis because it releases neurotrophins. Right, so it can do a lot of stuff. And also what? It can take nutrients from this capillary and deliver it directly to this neuron right here. So astrocytes are really important. Also forms what? The blood-brain barrier that we talked about. All right, let's go to the next topic in this chapter, probably one of the more fascinating topics, though the function of astrocytes is pretty fascinating in the job that it does to keep our brains young and healthy. All right, membrane potential. Well, what can you tell me about every healthy cell in your body, which is kind of a strange concept? Every cell in your body acts like a, because it's negative where on the inside and it's positive on the outside, what does that remind you of? Something that can separate charge out, a battery. All cells, every living cell in your body acts like a battery because it's negative on the inside and positive on the outside. And can you remember any ions that are responsible for that? Like sodium and potassium? Where do you find, what about potassium? Is it equal concentration on the in and the outside? No. Where is it high? It's high on the inside. Not high enough to completely neutralize all the negative charges inside the cell, right? Because when potassium builds up on the inside, then it's going to have a tendency to want to go back out down its concentration gradient, right? But the Nernst equation will tell you what that equilibrium balance is, right? What about another ion? Oh, somebody said sodium. Is sodium equal concentration on the in and the out? It's the opposite way. Now sodium is high on the outside, right, and low on the inside. And we looked at all the reasons why, like the sodium-potassium pump and things like that. So there, every cell has what we call a resting membrane potential, right? And that's negative on the inside. And from here on out, I'm just going to call that RMP to save my voice a little bit. All right, so at rest, all cells have a negative internal charge and unequal distribution of ions, which we just went over. That's because there are large what kind of ions trapped inside the cell? Look at that. That's a misprint, but that's a huge conceptual error. It should be what? Large, anions, right? Because it's negative on the inside. Cross that out on your slides. Anybody who's not here today, make sure you cross that out. Maybe I mentioned that in previous classes, maybe not. All right, but the sodium potassium pump. Okay, now why is the sodium potassium pump electrogenic? What can you tell me about the movement of sodium potassium? Is it 1:1? Is it 2:2? Is it 3? It's what? It's 3 sodium for every 2 potassium, right? So that produces a little negative charge on the inside of the cell as well, right? Because it's pumping more positive charges out. The other thing is the permeability, and we're going to focus mostly on that in this particular chapter. The permeability also changes the membrane potential, right? And potassium is very permeable, and it's high on the inside of the cell because it's attracted by those anions inside the cell. The thing that affects the membrane potential mostly in a living cell is a permeability of the membrane to these various ions, or a change in permeability is going to change the membrane potential. So membranes are very excitable, right? These cells can discharge their RMP quickly because there are rapid changes to permeability to ions across the membrane. So can an ion move across a membrane all by itself? Tell me something about that membrane. What's the simplest way to think of a membrane? Phospholipid bilayer? What's the inside layer? It's nonpolar. So anything that has a charge or is polar in nature can't get through the cell membrane. So ions like sodium and potassium can't get through the cell membrane unless the cell membrane is modified. But in real life, we know what's the best way to think of a membrane. Not just a simple phospholipid bilayer, but the model you should have is what? The fluid mosaic model. There are proteins and other kinds of things added to the cell membrane that change its structure that does what? That's going to change the function. It's going to change the membrane from being just a pure barrier to one that can be maybe selectively permeable or permeable to an ion at certain times but not other times. So that's what we're going to look at. Okay, so cells are excitable because of the proteins that are in the membrane. We can measure the electrical properties of a cell by putting in an electrode inside the cell and an electrode outside the cell. Basically, this is just a voltmeter, and display what it looks like on an oscilloscope that we have right here. So we can plot out the voltage versus time. And so on the vertical axis, we're measuring voltage, and then on the horizontal axis is just a plot of voltage versus time. And here is zero voltage. So if the cell was actually dead, right, then we would measure a zero voltage, or if you had a battery at home that was dead, if you put a voltmeter across the two terminals, it would read zero voltage. But one is inside of a living cell, and what did we say is the voltage inside a living cell, positive or negative? So would we look up here or down below zero for a living cell? It has to be down below zero, and we see minus 70 millivolts, the scale is millivolts right here, which is a typical kind of reading that we'd see on a typical cell. About minus 70 millivolts, this dotted line is what we call the resting membrane potential. If the membrane potential moves away from minus 70 up to zero, is the voltage getting less or greater as you move from minus 70 to zero? It's actually, okay, you know what? It's actually going to zero, so it's becoming less, okay? So that voltage is decreasing, it's going away because it's going to zero. We call that depolarization. And I know that was a little tricky, that's why I said it just that way, okay? So if it's becoming less negative, going to zero, it is depolarizing. But if you're at resting membrane potential and it becomes more negative, the voltage is increasing, it's just becoming more negative, we call that hyperpolarization. And we're going to see that depolarization is going to be synonymous in our thinking in terms of stimulation, and hyperpolarization is going to be synonymous with inhibition of neurons. All right. Once you depolarize a membrane to get it back to resting membrane potential, that's what we call repolarization. So depolarization goes to zero, repolarization brings it back. If it goes way beyond RMP, then that's what we call hyperpolarization. And these things we can measure pretty easily with an oscilloscope. And these electrodes are really small because they have to fit in an axon right here. But you know what? You think they're really hard to make or easy to make, these little electrodes? They're really easy to make. Just take a glass tube that you had in lab, put it over a Bunsen burner and pull it really fast. And as you pull it really fast, the glass tube just shrinks down, but the center stays open, right? And then the tip is really microscopic. But you, as you can imagine, you have to be really careful with those, because if you have one with a little microscopic tip, guess what? You can't see where the tip is unless it's what? Underneath a microscope. So you got to be careful where you poke those things. And that acts like a little electrode you can place inside of a cell. Okay, so membrane potential changes occur by the flow of ions across the cell membrane. But through the simple phospholipid bilayer, it can't. There has to be special little protein channels, and we call those things membrane channels. Right, so some channels are normally open. Some are normally closed. It depends on the ion and the state of the membrane. All right. For potassium, there are leak channels in the membrane that are open all the time. So potassium has a tendency to move inside the cell when that happens. And when potassium enters the cell, what happens to the membrane potential? Let's see if we can figure that out. If you're at a resting condition, what's the charge inside the cell when the membrane's at rest, when the cell's at rest? It's negative, yeah, it's negative. So if potassium enters, what happens to the membrane potential? Okay, it actually goes up as a result of that. Oh, yeah, it goes up, okay, because it's entering the cell, okay? All right, so that's how I want you to think about some of these changes that we're going to be talking about. So closed channels have molecular gates that can be opened or closed depending on what the voltage is. We call those voltage-gated channels. All right, they're opened by changes in the resting membrane potential, like depolarization. When the membrane potential depolarizes, goes to zero, then some of these channels go from a closed state to an open state. All right, so voltage-gated potassium channels are closed in resting, and sodium channels are voltage-gated. They're closed in the resting condition as well. So sodium and potassium for these kind of gated channels are always closed in the resting cell. So what does that look like? What do you see right here? Nice phospholipid bilayer. Ions can't get across it. But here is a protein, right? And this is a channel. And is this channel open or closed right now? Looks closed to me. It's not patent, right? So here is a closed resting membrane channel. And then under certain circumstances, this protein can change conformation. Maybe it has a receptor on it, or, for instance, probably even a better way to think about this, since we're talking about a voltage-gated channel right here, if we change the electrical properties across the cell, maybe going from negative to less negative right here. Remember, there are all kinds of positive and negative charges on amino acids that make this protein. And what can you tell me about same charges? Same charges, like plus and plus. They'll repel each other. What about opposite charges? They will attract. So if you change the electrical properties across this membrane because these proteins have charges on them, can you see that these opposite and same charges will have a tendency to pull and push on the walls of the protein because they have charges on them? That would be like, if you change the electrical property of the membrane, that would be like poking you in the side. What's going to happen to you? You're going to go a conformation change, right? So this protein will change conformation. When the voltage changes across the membrane, it will open up. And when it opens up, what can happen? Let's think about what will happen. Let's think about sodium in particular. Where is sodium at a high concentration? On the outside, low on the inside. So does sodium want to enter the cell? Sure, just by a concentration gradient. But there's another reason why. Can anybody see another reason why sodium would want to enter the cell? What's the charge of all that sodium out here? It's positive, but what's the charge inside the cell? Negative. What do opposite charges do? They attract each other. So now sodium wants to enter the cell because of the electrochemical gradient. The chemical gradient is favorable for sodium entering, as well as the electrical gradient. All right, so now sodium is going to go through this channel. Can't get through the membrane otherwise. All right, and when sodium enters the cell, what happens to the membrane potential? It was negative, but now we got all these positive charges entering. What happens to it? What do we call that? We call that depolarization. All those positive charges neutralize the negative charges inside the cell, And now the membrane potential goes from minus 70, right, minus 60, minus 50, minus 30, minus 40. And when it goes to zero, what do we call that? Toward the direction of zero is depolarization. Okay, now, one last thing. Some channels have special little protein side chains on them, so even though the main channel is open, right, this little ball and chain can plug up the channel. The channel is open, but this little thing right here is what we call an inactivation gate. And when the inactivation gate becomes activated, guess what happens to the flow of ions through this channel? It stops. Okay, so this is a really good model you have in your mind of a voltage-gated channel. It can open and close depending on the voltage across the membrane, and even when it's open, under certain circumstances, the inactivation gate can inactivate it. And we're going to see why this is important on the next couple of slides when we talk about voltage-gated channels. Oh, here is what? Something you should have committed to memory in your mind. And we're going to go over that. Too bad I didn't go over it today, because you have to draw that in lab. All right, so the sign-in sheet should be around someplace. That's it. Don't forget, the test is a week from this coming Thursday.